This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Season 2 of the popular podcast Defending Indiana is underway, and we're joined by the two comedians behind the show, Colleen Brennan and Janice Rodriguez. It's great to have you both back on the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you for having us.
Colleen, before we talk about the new season that's out, let's go back to season 1. How has the past year been for Defending Indiana?
It has exceeded our expectations. I think when we started this, we were just really hoping that our families would listen to it. But now we have a real audience, which is amazing, and I'm thrilled. And I think it's largely because of the gracious guests who've agreed to join us and talk about all these different topics. And I have been pleasantly surprised at how many people have enjoyed defending the state with us.
Well, that's pretty much something that will bring people together, I suppose, defending Indiana. Janice, is there anything that if you look back at season 1 to now, how things have been for the show?
Yeah, I mean, just like Colleen said, just the growth of people listening. You know, we get our little stats and I'm like, how did this person find out about it? And like just the other day, a friend texted me. I've been talking about this for like a year, I feel like. And he's like, hey, I found you on Spotify. And I was like, you didn't see any of my 500 social media posts about this. So same thing. I think Colleen's trying to get her sister to listen. I'm just trying to get friends of mine. So people are finding us strange ways, maybe now because we have so many listeners. So many, look at us. Like,
yeah,
we have, it's okay from the stat perspective that maybe we're moving up in an algorithm or something. But just the fact that I didn't think people would want to talk about Indiana this much, but you know, it's our home state and there's a shared commonality there. And I think we've just kind of, you know, touched a nerve, I think, with people. And I'm excited for the new season.
To piggyback on Janice, I think it's also been there are a lot of people who want to talk about Indiana and defend Indiana, but it's opened up a broader conversation about thinking about how we categorize and characterize people and how we shouldn't be using place to do that and location. We should really spend more time listening and hearing each other and trying to understand rather than just generalizing based on a location.
That's a good point because there are so many generalizations made on people just because if somebody says, I come from this town, like, oh, really? So you must really love pineapple or something like that.
Right.
You know, maybe make some random association.
Right.
Like, no.
Like, did I tell you I like pineapple? Yeah. And I mean, I'll be honest, like you can hear me in the first season, catch myself. I've thrown on like a Southern accent sometimes to talk about people south of 30. It's horrible. I know. And I am part of the problem. And, but that's what's so great about this. We've met so many people. We're trying to really expand across the state because we're both, you know, from the region and, you know, we get our little kind of bubble being close to Chicago and we're like, hey, there's a whole state out there. And again, I admit I have my own misconceptions. So this has been like kind of a journey for me personally as well.
Yeah.
Are there any favorite shows that you've done for season 1, Janice?
Well, I'm biased, and I might have said this in the other interview, but my dear friend who married me, actually, who married me and my husband, I should say, Erica Ridley, who's a USA Today and New York Times bestselling author, we had her on. And it was so funny because I was like, we're like, you know, in production meeting trying to figure out guests. And I'm like, wait, like my best friend is from Elkhart. So I just loved having her on because, again, the conversations, it was just in time, like when Bridgerton was coming out. And so it was just like this perfect like alignment of, you know, like romance was really hot, you know, at that exact moment. It still is, guys. But and then we were talking about, you know, it was Indiana romantic and just taking that concept and going further with it. And, you know, Colleen and I always have such a great time. So but that sticks out for me.
And what about you, Colleen?
Again, I really do love them all.
You're such a mom, Colleen.
Hard because so much.
They're all my babies.
There's every single topic that we choose is something that genuinely interests us. And in addition to being like, you know, the butt of jokes, it's also like, well, wait, we really do need to know a little bit more about this. Or how do we really feel about this when we're really breaking it down? So like literally every episode, I think is great. I do love the Erica Ridley episode too, though, because we learned some really weird stuff about Elkhart, Indiana. And also we're trying to coin the phrase, Indiana should be the bromance capital of the United States. And Janice, I keep hoping.
Yeah, we went so far. We still have to call the Indiana Tourism Board. We we have some concepts for them.
We do.
Some storyboards. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm sure they'd be open to it since you are defending their state. So, well, are there any guests that you spoke with that changed your perspective or opened you up to something new? I know you just mentioned that you learned some weird things about Elkhart, but is there anything else?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead, Colleen.
I think that Dr. Jim Madison from Indiana University, we wanted to talk about the KKK, you know, a light subject in Indiana. And he shed some light on it and some interesting facts that I didn't realize were true. And he cleared up some misconceptions. So I thought that was a thoughtful, eye-opening and incredibly informative episode.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you turn a topic like that in a more comedic way?
You don't.
You don't. Yeah, you just don't. Just don't. We struggled so hard. I'm like, none of this is funny at all.
No.
And that's one thing I will say that, and Colleen and I have had a lot of side convos about this. Like, we were like, we're two comedians. This is going to be fun and we're going to keep it light and it's funny. And now it's taken a little, you know, NPR-ish turn where we're like, wait, are we serious journalists now? Like, we're bringing up stuff. We're like, let's make sure we're fact checking. Let's make sure we're, I think everyone should, right? But it started out, I think, one way. And then we kind of discovered it's going a slightly a different way, which is great, which is like better than my original expectations, but just the level of guests we've had, the topics we've covered. It's really superseded my expectations. Seriously. I thought we were just going to be joking a lot.
And we do, just we do, not, but, you know, there are just certain episodes where we don't.
Right.
Yeah.
But the fact that we have that kind of platform where people will like maybe, actually listen to us. And I mean, if we can give our perspective and maybe make something more approachable, that's my goal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit of a balance of the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, when it comes to season two, I know you have some guests lined up. Can you give us a sneak peek or give us some insider info on who you'll be speaking with?
Yeah. So our first episode, which was just released last week, features Tony Costello. He's a professor emeritus of architecture from Ball State University, a fellow for the American Institute of Architects. And he talks about Columbus, Indiana, which Janice and I knew nothing about. And
wait, it's not Columbus, Ohio?
No.
No. Columbus, Indiana.
Columbus, Indiana, number 6 in most architecturally relevant cities in America. And it's in our own state. And I knew nothing about it, like literally nothing.
I knew a little bit about it, but just having Tony, I can call him Tony. He told us to. Having Tony break everything down for us and explain just sort of the history behind it and why this happened and how a small town in Indiana became like this architectural mecca was just fascinating. So we've got that. Can I announce our next episode's guest?
Do.
Can we do that? Our next guest is Ashley C. Ford. She is the New York Times bestselling author of her memoir, Somebody's Daughter. She's like, I don't even know how to give her justice because I don't have her bio sitting in front of me right now, but she's amazing. From Fort Wayne, originally moved to New York for about 6 or 7 years, then came back to Indiana and lives here now. But she's a writer, a journalist, a podcaster, a media entrepreneur. She's just amazing. So she's going to be episodes 2 and 3. Janice, anybody else you want?
Yeah. Well, Sarah Hindy then.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about refugees in Indiana. Again, another light subject. And the timing of this, we recorded a couple months ago, but with everything happening in Afghanistan, we're kind of revisiting and repurposing the episode a little bit, just making sure we're giving out the most recent information. But I mean, we're just going to keep, I think we have some other things lined up. We want to talk about Bobby Knight. We want to talk about Indiana breweries. We have a couple of things in the works. So we're really excited. We just want to keep talking to all these movers and shakers, if you will, in Indiana that maybe aren't getting, you know, the attention they need and deserve. So we're here.
Well, Janice, how has it been the response? How has it been so far for the podcast? I know you mentioned it's on Spotify now. People are noticing it. Any other kinds of responses or feedback?
Yeah, I mean, I think we hit the 2,000 download mark, which is a big deal, right? For a first season of a kind of a podcast that came out of nowhere. I'm going to say it's a big deal. I don't know if that's accurate.
I think
it's a big deal to us.
Yeah.
And we're getting, you know, some of those good numbers, but yeah, the feedback, I mean, we've just started to engage more people in social media. We could see where people are coming from and we're like, wait, who's listening in Ohio? Who's listening in Florida? Like, we're just trying to figure out who of our family or friends are listening, or did somebody share it with them? So yeah, I think the feedback's been really positive. We are very open to hearing more if they have a guest, a show idea. You know, we're going to be looking for sponsors soon, and we just kind of want to take this to the next level. And we've been really lucky that the reception's been so great.
And we're open too to other ideas from listeners. I mean, we'd love absolutely. People to engage and let us know what they want to hear about, what they want us to joke about. And I want to go on record as saying right now that no member of my family has really listened to this podcast. So my parents have not. My brothers listened to one episode where I mentioned him.
That's the thing. We have to name drop more. That's what we have to do.
So these are organic listens.
Right. It's the least you could do, Brennan's. Come on.
Come on.
And Brennan. Rodriguez's. I'm going to put you in there too.
Do you want family listening? Aren't they the ones that usually will be like, well, you should have said this. You should have said that. This would be funny if you did this.
You know what? That is such a good point.
But we need those numbers. We'll take it. We'll take it. That's so sad. It is such a thing in comedy too. It's like, we're going to come see you sometime. We're like, no, you're not. No. You know, it's been 5 years and you've never come once. So it's okay. Or worse, when they do try to give you feedback after the show, like, you know, it would have been funnier. So yeah, it is. You're right. It's a double-edged sword.
Well, before we wrap up here, our next segment is going to be about artificial intelligence in Indiana. So I just thought I would ask each of you, do you have any thoughts about artificial intelligence, AI?
Wow. Janice, I'm going to let you go first.
I was going to pass that one. It's the future. Yeah. I mean, I don't think people should be scared of what they don't know yet. There's a lot of AI already happening in a lot of the technology we use and in a lot of medical settings and things. So I'm excited for it. I think we need to kind of drop the sci-fi thing about the robots are going to take over and kind of look at the positives. So I'm excited for that segment. I'm going to listen. Ooh. I have like a wired subscription. I'm into this stuff, so I'm here for it.
I just, as long as there are ethicists and like
there you
people
go.
Still keeping the human aspect of being human on Earth involved in AI, I'm all for making life easier.
Well, thank you both for joining us. It's been great to have you on. Colleen Brennan and Janice Rodriguez are the hosts of the popular podcast Defending Indiana. We'll be back for a quick break. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. Artificial intelligence, or AI, is all around us. What is it used for, and where does Indiana stand in the grand scheme of technology? With us now to talk about the various projects and programs, as well as the applications for AI, are Xiaofan Fang, Director of the Institute of Integrative AI and Chair of Computer Science Department at IUPUI, and David Crandall, Professor of Computer Science and Director of Graduate Studies of Computer Science at Indiana University Bloomington. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Let's start with defining artificial intelligence. It's become a term often associated with science fiction. Xiaofan, how would you describe it?
Well, artificial intelligence is not a new field that's been around for a long time. It's mainly originally concerned with the understanding of the mechanism underlying intelligent behavior and the implementations in computers. But I think it's become very hot and very popular these days because of the different techniques such as machine learning, data mining, high-performance computing, just make AI a lot more practical for applications. So it becomes very, very useful right now. So, so essentially, it's a computer implementation of intelligent behavior. That's the way I look at it.
What about you, David? How can someone who's not in the field better understand it?
Yeah, we could probably talk about this for the next 20 minutes, if not for the next several weeks. I think I would define it similar to Xiaofan, but I think I'd just say that it is like computer systems and computer software that sort of seems to behave intelligently. In other words, that, you know, does things that we don't necessarily think of computers being good at, like just adding numbers together, arithmetic and stuff like that, but instead really doing things, you know, smartly, making decisions the way people might make them, learning from data over time and adapting its behavior to that and so on. So doing intelligent seeming things.
Well, Xiaofen, how do you incorporate AI in the work that you do?
The power of AI right now is the application. So how AI can be used in different disciplines. So in our institute, our primary mission is to help different disciplines to adopt AI technology in their own research field or in their own business and so on. I think that's the main mission right now. And AI in the computing domain does not give you the full power. The full power comes from application, I think. So the main thing right now is get people to learn AI, get people to accept AI, get people to adopt AI in their business, in their research, and so on.
Would you say if somebody's adopting AI into their business, would that be, for example, using it to compute, I don't know, a spreadsheet of data instead of doing it by hand? They would just plug in the numbers somehow?
No, that's not AI. That's just computing. So, AI would be a lot more intelligent. So in other words, AI, sometimes you would think, okay, AI behave like a human. So as if there's a human in this process to help you make decisions, make intelligent decisions, I would say.
Okay. And that does sound a little bit scary when you're trying to say that the computer is now turning into sort of like human behavior. How do you separate the two, I guess I'm wondering?
Yeah, that's a million-dollar question, I suppose. There are a lot of people study that. This is what AI is, a new problem AI is creating, an ethics problem, right? AI create this huge ethics problem. How do you make sure AI behave, in the proper way? So that itself is a big research problem in the AI community right now.
Right. And we're definitely going to be talking about that a little later in the program with a researcher delving into ethics and AI. David, you've worked on projects that use AI. Can you tell us about some of them?
Sure. Yeah. So my specific research area is in computer vision. And so that's the area of AI that sort of tries to get computers to be able to see the world the way that people are able to. And so we apply it to applications like self-driving cars, because, of course, a self-driving car needs to see the road around it to make safe decisions. Some health applications like, say, smarter x-ray machines, smarter health imaging devices that might be able to help a radiologist, say, make better decisions about what they're seeing. Everything from that to things like the apps on your phone that help organize your photos. You know, I have something like 50,000 photos on my phone. It's really hard to find what I'm looking for. But these days we have new techniques where they can audit the app itself can automatically find faces. It can automatically find objects and so on and help me organize that way. And then sort of in the broader community of AI folks here, again, I could spend, an hour probably talking about all the things that are going on. But just to give a few examples, in our school, we have folks working on things like intelligent hearing aids that are trying to sort of not just like make everything in the environment louder, but really isolate maybe only a person who you're talking to, only their voice, so they're easier to understand. We have folks working in robots and human-robot interaction, trying to make safer transportation networks, for example, and robots in the home that might be able to help, say, elderly people better navigate their lives. And then we have a lot of people working on things like fundamental kinds of techniques like machine learning, where sort of systems learn over time from data for things like, say, predicting earthquakes more effectively and more accurately. So there's really a wide range of things going on.
That's really cool. There's so many unique applications. And I'm just thinking about like the self-driving cars and stuff like that. When I was a kid, I thought cars would be flying by the time I became an adult, but maybe someday, but at least there's these self-driving cars. So that's pretty cool. Xiaofen, Indiana isn't the first place that comes to mind when we talk about computer science and AI. We may tend to think about Silicon Valley, and now Austin, Texas seems to be the place where big tech is moving. And with Indiana universities working more on things like AI and computer science and technology, how do you keep talent here instead of having them leave as soon as they graduate?
Yeah, this is a big problem for Midwestern states. So in Indiana, I think a lot of the AI initiatives have that in mind. So for our institute, that is also a major mission for us to not only help develop the workforce in AI for the state, also help the state retain the talents we develop and attract talents from out of state. So this is a mission I think not only the university should be engaged in, also the state government and the business should coordinate to help with this. For example, one of the things we are doing is this year we developed a new AI degree, a bachelor degree in AI. This is the first in the state, very few in the country. So that's where we start to develop AI workforce for the state. But you have those students coming in, get the degree, but you have to keep them. In the past, we do have most of our students going out of state to the West Coast, East Coast. It's a challenge to keep them here. But I start to see a lot of progress we have made. For example, I would say 5 years ago, most of our students are going to West Coast. Right now, well, I see students, perhaps almost half of them staying in state. So that's a huge progress, I would say. I think thanks to all those the initiatives the state make and the university make.
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty big number if half of them are staying. Right. David, what are your thoughts about talent retention?
Yeah, so I really think it's a matter of sort of identifying what are Indiana's unique strengths. And I think we really have unique strengths so that many people don't have to move to Silicon Valley to do what they're looking to do. You know, Indiana, for example, is a powerhouse in healthcare industry, and there's so many applications around AI for healthcare. There's industry and government here. The Crane Naval Base, which is about 30 miles south of Bloomington, hires a lot of our students, and they do really interesting advanced work there. And then, you know, I think, like, if we're thinking just about IU specifically, I think a lot about how to recruit students here as well. And I think, like you said, it's not necessarily the first place people think about when they think AI. But as Xiaofen said, I think applications of AI are really important. And when you start thinking about many of the strengths of IU and Indiana in general, you know, IU has a top-rated psychology department, for example, and a lot of the things that we're studying in AI overlap with, as Xiaofen said, with human intelligence. We have, you know, top programs in music, we have top programs in ethics and humanities and so on. And I think all of these are interesting and I think maybe somewhat unique combinations of AI and other fields that I think we can really be competitive in.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Xiaofen Fang, Director of the Institute of Integrative AI and Chair of Computer Science Department at IUPUI, and David Crandall, Professor of Computer Science and Director of Graduate Studies of Computer Science at Indiana University, Bloomington. And we're learning about artificial intelligence, or AI, and what it's used for, as well as where Indiana stands in using and promoting the technology. Xiaofen, what is the importance of keeping up with technological advancements in computer science, for example, and why should it be done here in Indiana? I guess what I'm wondering is, what's the argument to make Indiana stand out?
Well, the the main point is you have to build an infrastructure to attract or ecosystem to attract the talents to come to Indiana. So that will require the investment from the government and the state and the universities as well. A second thing I think a lot of people are looking for is the talent pool. Do you have the workforce that you can work on this? So that will fall onto the university to educate your students to make sure we have the most advanced AI program, academic programs that the people can find talents, workforce in this. I think for Indiana, this infrastructure is very important. So make sure the government is working with the universities, with the business, to build an ecosystem, build an infrastructure, build a environment that people can develop AI-related business here.
Well, with the pandemic and a lot of people working remotely, do you think that has attracted more folks to Indiana due to the cost of living?
Yeah, I think that's perhaps one of the few advantages we can perhaps take from the pandemic is that people find out that, yeah, coming to Indiana has a lot of benefits. If you move your business here, if you work on AI, moving to Indiana give you a lot of benefits. So I think the important thing for us to do is to make sure people coming here, they have the required infrastructure, they have the required workforce and things like that. Then people will be willing to take that advantage.
David, do you see more folks expressing an interest in AI? I know you're teaching a really large class this semester. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, it's a very exciting and kind of overwhelming time, I think, for the whole field, because there's so many jobs, so many companies that are pouring money into applications of AI and trying to hire folks to work in these areas. And, you know, as I have said before to you, I think the first time I taught like my computer vision class 10 years ago, I remember I had to like twist arms for students to take the class because otherwise they would cancel the class because it was too small. And this semester, I have some, you know, close to 300 students in my intro graduate level AI class. And so people are really excited. And I think we're trying, at least here at IU, to also reach out sort of across the different levels of education. And so we have several programs that were announced recently for reaching out to rural middle school students and getting an AI, some AI education into that curriculum. We have an AI for Everyone program run through our Center for Women in Technology, Excellence in Women in Technology, that is sort of looking at issues of AI ethics. And we have other programs that are reaching out to undergrads and grad students and elementary students as well. So I think it's something that sort of hopefully will span the whole curriculum.
Are there any exciting projects you're working on now that you can share some details about?
There are, again, many. So I think the one that I'm most excited about, we have recently, it was announced that we are going to be here at IU, we're going to be part of a National Science Foundation AI Institute, and we're actually going to be part of two of them. One of them is focused on building infrastructure, computational infrastructure for AI. The other one, which is the one that I'm involved in, is looking at how to apply AI in elementary classrooms to maybe make the jobs of teachers a little bit easier, but also how to sort of integrate AI concepts into elementary school classrooms to sort of get, you know, students thinking about AI and thinking about maybe pathways in computer science, you know, before middle school, before they're making decisions in high school. We really have it be sort of throughout the curriculum.
Oh, that's really cool. And Xiaofen, we have about 2 minutes left, so I'd like to ask you the same question. Are there any sort of exciting projects you're working on that you can share details about? Maybe give us a sneak preview.
Sure. Yeah. Because IUPUI has a lot of, it's a very comprehensive campus. We have a lot of different schools here. So the AI application is also very diverse. For example, we use a lot of AI techniques in medical diagnosis. I personally involved in some research with facial recognition to do medical diagnosis, because a lot of disease, it shows up on your face. So your facial features can tell whether the person has that particular disease. We also work with a lot of social science people on, for example, analyzing social media conversations and detect, for example, mental health issues with young kids or adolescents on, for example, suicide trajectory detection. Those are the type of, you know, very diverse AI applications that we are getting really excited about right now.
That's really fascinating, learning about all the different applications that AI can be used for. And I'm sure we could talk about this forever, so I'd love to have you guys on again in the future. Thank you so much for joining us. Xiaofan Fang, Director of the Institute of Integrative AI and Chair of Computer Science Department at IUPUI, and David Crandall, Professor of Computer Science and Director of Graduate Studies of Computer Science at Indiana University Bloomington. Coming up after a quick break, we will hear from a researcher at Notre Dame about the ethics of AI. Where do we draw the line between computers and humans? There's a whole field that looks into that. If you have questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Artificial intelligence, or AI, is often portrayed in dystopian-themed books and movies in a way where the world ceases to exist as we know it and machines start to take over. How likely is that to happen? And when it comes to using AI to do work, are there any ethics that should be considered? With us now is Nitesh Chawla, director of the Lucy Family Institute for Data and Society at the University of Notre Dame. Welcome, Nitesh.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. Happy to be here.
Nitesh, before we get into the ethics of artificial intelligence, can you tell us about the work you're doing at Notre Dame?
Absolutely. So as you introduced, I'm the director for the Lucy Family Institute for Data and Society at Notre Dame, and as well as the Frank Freeman Professor of Computer Science. And what truly excites us, and when we think about data and society, and even as we frame it in the lens of ethics, and what does it mean to domain-informed and data-driven advances to AI or data science, and what does it mean to have an impact on society? What does it mean to advance the common good? And those are the questions that we ask, because it's important to look at the first mile with how do we immerse in ourselves in a problem statement, whether it's, say, climate change or it's inequities, disparities in healthcare. How do we form and frame the normative question? And while we are doing that, how do we take the attributes or aspects of ethics and fairness and transparency into account? Then we develop data science AI methods cognizant of those challenges, those attributes. And then we think about the last mile where we go, okay, we have done this innovation. How do we measure impact on society? Has it changed one's life? Has it impacted policy, et cetera? So this sort of is the beginning to the end journey that we are trying to embrace at Lucy Family. And we can only do that through a very interdisciplinary mindset in our research, where we focus on the problem statement that may require a social scientist working with a computer scientist and a policymaker or a social services site person, et cetera.
You know, it's interesting. You're mentioning that some of the guests that we had on earlier also mentioned this interdisciplinary approach with AI. And is that something that's new in the last 5 to 10 years, or has it always been this way?
So I think it has existed, but it's becoming more and more paramount in the last few years. And especially as we think about some of the biggest challenges that we may have, whether it's climate change, poverty, the pandemic that we are trying to get out of, or inequities, these problem statements don't come and say, hey, I'm a computer science problem statement. Computer scientists, please solve me. To solve that, one may need to work with a social scientist, with a health, with a medicine person, with a epidemiologist, with a policy person, with a political science person, to truly solve that problem. So if we are in the business of taking on some grand challenge problem statements, we cannot lock ourselves into a domain of one discipline. We have to bridge boundaries. We have to work at interfaces.
When it comes to ethics, I was reading up on some of the issues with AI and machine learning. And I wonder if you're studying some of those things, such as programs where they want to do facial recognition and they're taking pictures off the internet and people may not have consented to have their faces used in this project. Is that one of the ethical concerns that you cover, or are there other types of debates?
So there are colleagues of mine within, so we have a technology ethics center as well at Notre Dame, and there are colleagues of mine in computer science and other disciplines who are in fact thinking about and looking at what happens if the facial image is used without permission, and what does it mean if something, I guess, so I personally am not, but there are colleagues of mine working. But the way I think about this is, what does it mean to be in the public domain to begin with? What if my face, my picture is in a public domain that I consented to put in a public domain? Let's start there. And what does it mean for secondary user rights to that?
Right. I mean, that's also, I think, even from journalistic standards, you know, that the whole idea of public domain and using things that are already out there. But I'm also curious, you know, how, you know, as humans, how will we be able to keep up with the way technology is quickly changing, how machines are able to adapt and learn from our own behaviors? Can we keep up with that?
I think I feel that technology is moving much faster than we can imagine or expect it to. So there's absolutely a much faster pace in change of technology. And we are constantly we are active participants in making the technology better and faster. If you think about the way an AI algorithm or a machine learning algorithm works, you have, they rely on training data. They rely on enriching their experience of a learning algorithm or an AI algorithm based on more data points they see, based on the diversity of data points they see. So as we interact with these, whether imagine watching Netflix or searching on Google, every time we click on a link or we watch something, we are telling those systems, those technology systems, these are the things I like. These are the things I like to watch. These are the things I'm searching. If I go to the second page of my Google search, I'm giving a very important piece of evidence that your first page rankings weren't good enough, so I moved on to the second page. So the technology, in fact, this whole idea of human-machine collaboration and the technology getting faster, we are, in fact, feeding it in that virtuous loop because we are part of the data collection. We are the data.
That sounds kind of scary when you say we are the data. How do we separate ourselves from this? Or are we just going to all become one at some point?
No, I think, you know, we talk about, you know, if from a journalistic standpoint or even from a marketing standpoint, you know, initially, just even from a journalistic standpoint, before, imagine the world where we would have these newspapers go out to everybody's house. You had no idea what page of the newspaper I was looking at. Was I looking the sports section? Was I looking at the classified section? Was I just on the front page looking at headlines? How many times I leaf through the pages? What page I spent more time on? You had no idea. So it was sort of reaching out. And so it was the market of many. What's happening now is the market of one, where how many, you know, there are these pop-up headlines that pop into your phone, where everybody is now competing for the real estate of somebody's screen and making sure the key news items that need to be fed get fed to that person of one. So we are the data because we are telling you now what we read, which you couldn't have access to before when you were leafing through the newspaper pages. Now every click, every aspect of that is an information provided to give you a sense of our interest. And there's not, to be honest, there's not much we can do unless we basically tell ourselves that we accept no cookies that come from the browsers, or we would not be shopping online, and we would still be reading the news the way we used to with the newspaper in our hand, and we won't be clicking on any summarization of news and et cetera that happens. So I do not believe we can control much, but what we can do is provide literacy about data use. What does it mean to a lay person to be the data and how it's being used? That transparency is essential. Nobody reads 10 pages of terms and conditions. How do we distill it? There's an obligation here to tell someone, hey, this is how your data may be used. You may opt out
That's okay, but you still have access to the system. You may not get recommendations or market of one personalizations, et cetera. Then it becomes a choice.
It seems like there's been a lot of that lately where there's more information given to consumers about how their data is used and to opt out and stuff like that. And it always seems like Europe is way ahead of us in those types of things where they're, you know, have sort of rules around what data can be collected and what can't. Is there a reason why in the U.S. we're lagging behind in that type of implementation?
I don't know what's the policy implication of that, to be honest, because the technology is there. The technology is there for you, for us to acknowledge how my data is being used. Even though I applaud the GDPR in Europe, however, I still believe it's not quite there yet. It hasn't made it easier for someone to understand what does it mean. Right? These are the ways, what's the aspect of literacy, of understanding of what do I need, what does data literacy mean to explain to someone about data use? While it's a great step forward in Europe, but I still don't believe it's there. And I don't know why we can't implement that in the United States. Europe has shown that technology exists. The same companies that operate in the United States agree to, their systems operate under GDPR in Europe as well. So clearly we can do it. So I believe it's a policy question and less of a technology question here.
When it comes to retaining talent in Indiana, this is something that I spoke with the other guests previously. Do you think Notre Dame is poised to have programming and incentives for students to stay here versus leaving to the West Coast, for example, when they graduate?
That's a great question. And I believe Notre Dame is, and as well as some of the other exciting initiatives that we are involved in throughout the state. Number one, folks are, you know, as we graduate, are enamored by an opportunity of being at the cutting edge, right? At the opportunity of, hey, we can innovate something here. The possibilities of romanticizing with the idea of, hey, maybe I can be a founder. That inspiration comes from demonstration. So in the last few years, at least near Notre Dame, we have seen an emergence of technology companies. I started a company, co-founded a company myself called Analytics, which now employs a couple of hundred individuals, very strong technical data science talent in South Bend, Indiana. Right, so we can do it. It's a matter of, you know, coming together, the community, the universities, the innovators, the capital, to come together and say, okay, let's build something here. And since then, there are many other corporations that have spun up, and it's becoming a beacon of imagination in a student's mind. Hey, I could be here. I'm from the Midwest. I stay close to Notre Dame. There's amazing things that happen on campus all the time. We can do that. And we can also then attract faculty, et cetera, who may have a spouse working in private sector, another spouse working in academia, we can achieve it. And there's another exciting initiative that's been launched called Analytics Indiana, Analytics N. And Notre Dame, Purdue, IU, along with a group of companies within the state are part of that initiative. And the idea is talent recruitment to the state. What can we do to create an industry academe ecosystem to attract faculty students to the state, whether they're working in Indianapolis or in South Bend or other parts of the state, and get them connected to, we are a powerhouse in manufacturing. We are a powerhouse in life sciences. How do we now create the digital technology innovation system to support these industries, whether it's in healthcare, manufacturing, life sciences, and move that forward. Imagine Industry 4.0. Imagine the next wave of healthcare tech. Imagine the next wave of life science tech, drug discovery, et cetera. So there are clearly, I believe, we have just scratched the surface. And I strongly believe Indiana could be a hotbed of technology, innovation, and advancement in the coming times.
Would you have like a
a prediction, like in the next 5 years, it could be the next Silicon Valley?
I mean, I wouldn't make a prediction, but hey, although I'm an AI machine learning person, we live by predictions. That's what we do for a living. But, you know, if I were to speculate, I do believe that I wouldn't say we would try to mimic a Silicon Valley. We would be a place in the next 5 years that is use-inspired technology innovation hub. Too many words. What that I mean is listening to the market, whether it's, hey, manufacturing or healthcare or life sciences, and then imagining what technology should be. So developing technology, AI, towards a purpose. Not just saying, hey, we have all this money, we'll invest, come up with the next coolest thing or an app or a widget. Something that's going to solve a problem, which is consumed by vast population.
Well, we have about 40 seconds left. What would you say to somebody that is interested in AI but doesn't know where to start?
I would say if you're interested in AI, doesn't know how to start, it depends on, you know, what the undergraduate degrees or your high school experience or your graduate school experience and everything else. Start with curiosity. Start with asking, what if I could learn something from this data? As we talked about Viola data, what can I do better? What if I could learn from people's experiences? What can my system do better? That's what I would put.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Nitesh Chawla is director of the Lucy Family Institute for Data and Society at the University of Notre Dame and the Freeman Professor of Computer Science and Engineering. Our producers are Drew Doblin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.